Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the remarks by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse at last week's dramatic Senate hearing when he questioned Judge Kavanaugh, referring to him as the culmination of a long strategy by powerful special interests who have already seated Roberts, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and now a possible fifth, who will ensure a far-right-wing conservative majority on the Supreme Court for decades to come. Francis Kissling, the former president of Catholics for Choice, who writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs at religiondispatches.org, joins us to discuss the pivotal role of Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society in stacking the Supreme Court and the Federalists' ongoing TV campaign boosting Brett Kavanaugh through the dark money pouring into their judicial crisis network. We will look into Leo's membership of the secretive, extremely conservative Knights of Malta and his closeness to Cardinal Burke, Stephen Bannon's mentor and a fierce critic of Pope Francis, who is undermining the Pope's efforts to reform the Catholic Church. We will also investigate the money and motives behind the funding of Leo and the Federalists by Koch Industries, the Murtha Family Foundation, the Chamber of Commerce, Chevron, Google, Microsoft, and Pfizer. Then we will speak with Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, who was the Chief Economist for the United States Senate Banking Committee and the Budget Committee. We will discuss his article at Project Syndicate with George Soros, A Better Bailout Was Possible, and his recent trip to London to find a way out of the political paralysis surrounding the Brexit crisis, with the leader of the UK Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, appearing to waffle over whether to support a do-over vote. Then finally, actor and activist Mike Farrell joins us to discuss his one-man performance in an updated version of George Shea's climate change play, Dr. Keeling's Curve, which is presented by the Sierra Club. We will discuss how the scientist Dr. David Keeling gave the world its first warning of global warming from his research on CO2 60 years ago, and the painfully slow progress in recognizing the clear and present danger of the increase in global warming from the unrelenting and ongoing release of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, in spite of the manifest global evidence of worsening droughts, floods, fires, and rising sea levels. And joining us now is Francis Kissling, president of the Center for Health, Ethics, and Social Policy, and a former president of Catholics for Choice, a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. She serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethical Project, and she writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs for religiondispatches.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Francis Kissling.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ian.
So I don't quite know where to start, Francis. I mean, I guess we should at least touch on the where we stand with the Kavanaugh hearing, in as much as the FBI investigation that the president has ordered. There's some confusion over. Trump is saying it's just open, and you know they can, the FBI can question anybody and anyone they want to, but it's much clearer from other White House sources that it's not that case, that they're basically only going to look into Dr. Blasey Ford's allegations and the second woman at Yale, Deborah Ramirez. It seems like the client of Michael Abernethy is not being considered. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that is my understanding. She's the third, Avenetti's client has not been contacted yet. And, you know, I think it's perfectly possible that she won't be contacted and they'll concentrate on the first two. No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you can't help noticing that there's still this ad campaign on behalf of Brett Kavanaugh is still going on. In fact, it's intensified.
Yes.
And this is being conducted by the Judicial Crisis Network, which is a branch of Leonard Leo's, the Federalist Society. His protege, Carrie Severino, runs it, and she used to clerk for Justice Thomas, which may give you a clue into the kind of incestuous nature of this sort of right-wing cabal who are taking over the Supreme Court. They spent, the Judicial Crisis Network spent $17 million to defeat Merrick Garland and to promote Judge Gorsuch, another one of their projects, and Senator Sheldon Whitehouse back then during the Gorsuch hearings said, quote, there's a small group of billionaires who are working very hard to influence and even to control our democracy. They set up an array of benign-sounding front groups to both organize and conceal their manipulations of our policies. Well, the Judicial Crisis Network is a 501c4, so-called social welfare vehicle. So that means dark money can pour into it unaccounted. So that's what we're seeing now on our television sets. And White House, again, when he questioned Kavanaugh at last week's dramatic hearings, he again talked about these powerful special interests who may get their fifth guy on the court and therefore be able to turn the judiciary to the far right for decades to come. So what's your understanding of what White House is talking about?
Well, I think that, you know, I think that you actually pretty much laid it out in terms of the extent to which the Supreme Court has been a long-time agenda of both right-wing groups, you know, such as the Federalist Society and other dark money sources. But I think that one of the missing pieces of that is the extent when we are talking about the court and the Federalist Society, the extent of the involvement of conservative Catholics in this effort to really you know, stack the court with conservative Catholic jurists. I've always been amazed at the number of Catholic lawyers, I mean, that are in the Federalist Society, lawyers from Notre Dame, as well as the Catholics who ended up in prestigious, not that Notre Dame doesn't have its own prestige, but in top-ranked schools and have been making their way through the courts. I mean, I think that we do need to look a little bit at some of the lower courts in terms of how many Federalist Society and Catholic lawyers are getting on those courts. But it is definite, there definitely is, I mean, I'm very interested in Catholic angles on these things, that this is very, that this stuff with the court is very, very tied to Catholicism. And to conservative, ultra-conservative Catholicism. I mean, when you speak of Bannon and Burke and Leo under the enormous attack on Pope Francis at this point, you really see that at this point, right-wing Catholicism is far more prominent than a more traditional social justice Catholicism.
Well, they've so far they've got Roberts, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and possibly Kavanaugh, and of course Scalia, and Leonard Leo on the Federalist, or Leonard Leo,
Sotomayor on the other side of the lone Catholic on the other side of.
Right.
Of the dynamic, yes, and Thomas, of course, is not. I don't think he considers himself a Catholic any longer.
Well, yeah, he's like Gorsuch. He's married to a high Anglican church, they call it.
Yes, exactly.
But Ginny Thomas, of course, has worked with Leo, Leonard Leo. They became directors of Liberty Central, which is a Tea Party affiliated group, which Leo co-founded with Ginny Thomas, the wife of Clarence Thomas, and they went after the building of mosques at Ground Zero, etc.
Right, exactly. I remember that. Yeah. And so, I was very, very struck. When I was watching, I was glued to the television set. The last time I was glued to my television set, like as I was last week, was during the Watergate hearings, which I watched from gavel to gavel. I was just so, Kavanaugh so reminded me of every Catholic schoolboy I remember from my Catholic school days. They were and of course, this I'm going back to the 60s now, the late 50s and early, well, the 50s and 60s in terms of my Catholic school experiences. He is just a classic example of most of the boys who were in Catholic school. Bullies, arrogant, rude to women, I mean, basically demeaning. I think when Dr. Ford was asked by Patrick Leahy what is her memory most in her brain, it was the boys laughing at her as they were abusing her, that their laughter and the pleasure they took in demeaning her was most prominent. And when I saw Kavanaugh, as I say, he reminded me of the boys throughout my grammar school and high school who were exactly like that, totally demeaning of women and totally convinced of their importance.
And again, I'm speaking with Frances Kissling, who's the president of the Center for Health, Ethics and Social Policy and a former president of Catholics for Choice, a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. She serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project, and she writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs for ReligionDispatches.org. But Frances, the Jesuit, and of course, Georgetown Prep is a Jesuit school where both Gorsuch and Kavanaugh went, along with Mike Judge, etc. But the Jesuits newspaper or magazine, America. Yeah, I'll just read what they've just said, the editorial board. While we previously endorsed the nomination of Judge Kavanaugh on the basis of his legal credentials and his reputation as a committed textualist, it is now clear that the nomination should be withdrawn. The nomination of Judge Kavanaugh has become a referendum on how to address allegations of sexual assault. Think that'll have any impact?
I don't think it will have much impact. I mean, I think that America as a Catholic publication, it has been highly criticized in many quarters, and of course it does have somewhat of a reputation as a liberal publication, to some extent deserved and to some extent not. I think the more important questions in terms of Catholic support come from the U.S., obviously from the U.S. Catholic Conference. And the conference, the bishops' conference, and the bishops also endorsed Kavanaugh and have not rescinded their support for him. So I think they will in some senses be far more influential in this battle with Kavanaugh. I think that the other thing to keep in mind as we look at whether or not these charges against Kavanaugh have merit, I mean, aside from, the simple fact that Ford has absolutely no reason to bring this forward and to lie about it, number one, and Kavanaugh has every reason to lie about this. I mean, to admit to this would be to end up, losing this seat. So it's much easier to accept what Ford says than one to understand that, well, Kavanaugh, what happens if he says he did this? He's not going to be on the Supreme Court. And, lying obviously comes very easy to him. The other thing to keep in mind is the years when he was going to Georgetown Prep were years in which the Jesuits were embroiled in the sexual abuse scandal. There were any number of Jesuits, even in his own school, there was one case of a Jesuit who was credibly charged with sexual abuse of the boys in the school. The Jesuits defended him. Ultimately, he was convicted and went to prison. And there are numerous other examples from Chicago, Portland, Boston, other high schools where Jesuits were involved in sexual abuse of children, boys, because the Jesuits do, in fact, teach only boys. So there is a certain basis on which Jesuits, whom we tend to respect more for some reason, where Jesuits themselves lie with some frequency. Lying comes quite easy to conservatives in the Catholic Church.
The noble lie, as Plato referred to it. So,
yes.
Let's talk a little bit.
And also, the Straussian lie.
Right. Well, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about, though, because you're bringing up the issue of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, which, of course, is ironically what Cardinal Burke, and who's the mentor of Stephen Bannon, through one of his proteges, is using to attack Pope Francis, that he hasn't handled it sufficiently well, when it's the arch-conservatives within the Catholic Church have been engaged in the cover-up forever, and the enabling of this epidemic of sexual abuse. So let's talk a little bit about that kind of unholy trinity, Cardinal Leo Burke, and Bannon and their proteges attacking the Pope.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think that obviously even Francis, whom, you know, we tend to like more than his predecessors, none of them have handled the sexual abuse crisis well. There is, you know, I think when you look at the way in which the Catholic Church looks at sexuality, and raises it up to such a high level of sacredness and honor and beauty and everything else, and yet there is so much sexual abuse within the clergy itself, protecting, not admitting to sexual deviance by members of the Catholic Church, including Kavanaugh, including Georgetown Prep, and including the Pope, is a very, very important element of credibility. Of course, that element of credibility has been destroyed over the last 50, you know, since the Boston Globe came out with its theories, but there is still a clinging to this. And for people like Burke, and other conservatives within the church to complain about Francis around sexual about not handling a sexual crisis well is the height of ridiculousness. I mean, these were people who supported cardinal law and who are by no means calling for any punishment of the numerous bishops and cardinals who hid these abuses completely. I think that, you know, the ascendancy of Francis, and in a way you could say similar to the ascendancy of Obama in a different direction, so inflamed the right wing in the Catholic Church and initiated such enormous fear. And even the small steps that Francis has taken, not so much around sexual abuse, but around curbing the excesses of bishops financially, in terms of how they spend money, and the role that they are playing politically. Francis has not been particularly favorable to the high political involvement of the American clerics, and the church was a very, Catholic Church in the U.S., was and has been a very reliable voice on certain social justice issues, not on abortion, not on women, but definitely on all of the issues that they are hoping when Kavanaugh gets on the court, immigration, corporate power, corporate spending, the imperial presidency, you know, the presidency becomes somewhat like the Pope. It is so terribly important for them to combine with Bannon with the right-wing Catholic Student and the Federal Society, which is a conservative Catholic, largely a conservative Catholic group in terms of the numbers of Catholics who are its members, that they really must combine together, attack Francis, but more importantly, work together to promote in a variety of ways conservative Catholics, and that's what's going on. I don't think they think they will get Francis out of office. I think that's even harder than getting Trump out of office. But I do think they think that they can discredit him enough so that they can maintain that they can increase conservative Catholic influence.
Sure. Well, we've got to wrap it up here, but obviously what's happening now is an attempt by the FBI to bring some transparency. There's not been any transparency, and they are by nature, the Federalists, and particularly Leonard Leo, a secretive bunch. Leonard Leo is a member of the secretive, extremely conservative Knights of Malta, which is a Catholic order founded in the 12th century, and it functions as a quasi-independent sovereign nation. It has its own diplomatic corps, separate from the Vatican. It has United Nations status. And tremendous amounts of money and land.
Has financed a lot of political activities, particularly in the socially conservative area.
Sure, and I'm sure they're financing the new office that Stephen Bannon is opening in Rome.
I would have no doubt of this.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Frances Kissling.
Thanks to be with you. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Frances Kissling, who's president of the Center for Health, Ethics and Social Policy and the former president of Catholics for Choice, a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. She serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. And she writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs for religiondispatches.org. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with the former chief economist for the United States Senate Banking Committee and the Budget Committee. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He was Chief Economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and the Budget Committee, and he has an article at Project Syndicate with George Soros, A Better Bailout Was Possible. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Robin. Let's just touch a little bit on the situation vis-a-vis Kavanaugh. I was interested in your take on what Senator Sheldon Whitehouse was alluding to when he talked about powerful special interests, not just behind getting Kavanaugh on. And obviously, there's this massive TV campaign going on, funded by the Federalist Society's one of their offshoots. But we're learning, for example, that Leo and the Federalists are financed by the Koch Industries, the Mercer Family Foundation, the Chamber of Commerce, Chevron, Google, Microsoft, and Pfizer. Do you think that's what Senator Whitehouse was talking about, how they've already got Thomas, Roberts, Alito, Gorsuch on the court, and if they get this fifth guy, Kavanaugh, they've got a lock on an ultra-conservative majority for decades to come?
Well, I guess I would say that the constellation of corporations that you named may not be at the vanguard of backing Kavanaugh. It seems to be that what's on deck right now is the question of reproductive rights. And I would imagine conservative interests in the religious community are another dimension. As I read the language that Senator Whitehouse was focusing on, I do think, though, those packages kind of come together as a bundle. And people like the Koch industries who are involved in the energy industry, what you might call to the detriment of the environment, to the betterment of themselves, and various special favors for the Silicon Valley companies and so forth, will all be in the balance. This is a constellation of people who wield power and may, in fact, believe that Kavanaugh, as well as the other justices you named, provide a climate in the court that is, propitious for favoring them.
So let's turn to your article with George Soros, A Better Bailout Was Possible. It's 10 years now since the September 2008 crash, and we all remember the TARP, $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program. But what you and George Soros are arguing is that in what happened, in fact, was the greatest transfer of private debt into public debt in the history of the world, that you believe that it was too heavily in favor of creditors relative to debtors, and that the long-term social and political ramifications of this missed opportunity have been profound.
I believe you characterized things accurately. Both George Soros and myself, I used to work with Bankers Trust Company and then also with Soros Fund Management. And I had been involved with the Senate Banking Committee at the time of the 87 stock market crash and savings and loan bailout. So the notion of financial restructuring, and I'm not talking about this as an investor, but in relation to public policy, has various criteria. In other words, when people are polluters, the polluters are supposed to pay. When there's a chance in a very unequal society, the policies that are chosen should not be chosen to exacerbate the difference between the haves and the have-nots. Well, I don't blame any person, whether you can use names, Paulson, Geithner, Bernanke, Summers. These are not failures of imagination. What they are is a revelation of vested interests that underpin the structure of a bailout where essentially the people who made the mistakes did not pay the price. And because Democrats, when Obama came to office for change we can believe in, appeared to side with the status quo that came from the Paulson Treasury and the Bush administration, there was no perception of change. When there's no perception of change, the logs started rolling very quickly with Senator Kennedy's death and the by-election, the special election that led to Scott Brown beating Martha Coakley. I knew the pollster, Celinda Lake, who worked with Coakley, and she said to me a week before the election, this is all about the bonuses at J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs that were paid less than about 1 year after the bailout, maybe even a little less, and people are outraged, and the Democrats are going to suffer. And subsequently, you had Republican control of the House and the Senate. And as Steve Bannon said in New York Magazine in August, what is the implication of the 10th year anniversary of Lehman Brothers? He said, pure and simple, Donald J. Trump. So, and I'm not saying that Democrats all do bad and Republicans would do better or vice versa. What I'm saying is that the structure of the system, the lobbying, the money politics, is rancid, where you can't even do a bailout. And as Soros and I in the article, and the reason we wrote the article, is we worked together in the trenches during the TARP legislation and lobbying on Dodd-Frank very intensely for something that had a, what you might call a more equitable outcome, which would be invigorating of legitimacy and trust. George Soros grew up in the ramifications of the aftermath of an Austrian and German banking crisis that was horrific in 1931. And when he saw what was unfolding, the entity that I currently chair, I'm the president of, the Institute for New Economic Thinking, was founded because this was a dreadful outcome. And I'm not blaming any person. I'm blaming the systemic structures that need to be reformed and repaired so that we don't sit in a situation where the population is despairing continuously.
So Main Street suffered, Wall Street flourished, and they didn't pay any kind of price. So just going back to the politics, if you go back to the 29 crash, obviously it finished off Hoover when FDR was elected with a massive mandate. He did not help out Hoover. He waited until his own inauguration before he put in his policies. Did Obama make a mistake buying into the Bush-Paulson policies? What would you have suggested he do instead?
My opinion, my perception, is he made a profound mistake. That with the energy that he had coming into office, while there is a responsibility to stabilize the financial markets when you're afraid that they are, could take us all over the waterfall and everybody would lose, we had gone several months and the symptoms of acute distress were gone, and he did not do things. And I would have, for instance, if I had been in that chair, I would have strongly recommended the nationalization of Citigroup. Not permanently, not to have a government bank, but to break up the pieces, sell it back out to the market, and demonstrate to the executives and the stockholders that in a capitalist system, when you fail, you're at risk.
Well, I find
and
it...
For that matter, to the voters, characterizing the question. The voters say people pay the price when they make a mistake, and that is the discipline that we're all asked to submit to in our life, and these people would have had to submit as well.
Well, what I find a little ironic here, Rob Johnson, is that you know how George Soros has become the bête noire of the political right and also in Hungary with that sort of neo-fascist Orban, etc. Mm-hmm. The idea that he's some incredible Svengali behind the scenes manipulating everything. Well, you and he did the best you could, but it didn't work, right? He didn't have the influence that the right wing...
We didn't prevail, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Going back to what you said in the previous sentence, I think the reason George Soros is so demonized is, number one, very wealthy and powerful people have disproportionate influence. That's him, that's the Koch brothers, that's everybody else, and people resent that. Number two, many of the other people who have that kind of wealth and power resent him because he's putting a flashlight on them, which you might say the interests are private interests to make even more money by manipulating politics in the scheme and strategy of many. In George's case, he's trying to illuminate what is unhealthy for democracy, what is crippling democracy, what may end democracy, so that, society can, with his guidance, avoid going back to the kind of traumatic experience he had when the Nazis invaded Hungary when he was a child.
Well, it is an extraordinary irony that in spite of the fact that the crash happened on the Republicans' watch, that the electorate blamed the Obama administration and the Democratic Congress, and the Tea Party was formed in early 2009 with financial support from the billionaire Koch brothers. And as you pointed out, you can draw a direct line to the loss of the 2010 midterm elections, the takeover of the House and Senate by the Republicans, and the nomination of Donald Trump. Let's turn just in the last few minutes, Rob. You were recently in the UK, and I mentioned this in the opening, what's going on there with Brexit? Because there's such political paralysis. The European Union have basically told, given May the back of their hand, and she's a political cripple. It's the logical thing, and I believe Soros has been supporting this, the logical thing to do would be to have a do-over, just re-vote this damn thing, because clearly the public have figured out it was a terrible mistake, and the people behind it were such a bunch of lowlifes like Nigel Farage, who made the most outrageous promises and lied through their teeth with all of these racist implications of an invasion of brown people and black people and all this crazy stuff. They promised. But Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, seems to be waffling over and over whether or not to support a do-over.
Well, I guess I'm in, here. I might be a little different than George Soros and perhaps yourself. I think, in the aftermath of Thatcher, the British people got smashed. Not the people in London, but everybody north and south. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that Brexit, meaning leaving integration with Europe, is the right remedy to fix those problems. I think it had more to do with austerity and the distribution of cuts in state and local budgets, where the subsidies to London were enormous and the cuts out in the countryside were terrible. And so a kind of London as a globalist village, and the devastation of British citizens is the underlying reality when they don't live in that city. So where I go with that is, if you want to have a do-over, these people serve notice to you that your system is failing. And if you want to have a do-over now, the do-over you have to have is you got to say, what are we going to do to fix things for those people? Not just a revote on Brexit, where the money and the PR firms and the lobbyists can all fix the game and go back to business as usual. I think you have to go to the public and say, we're going to do things differently. And particularly in Europe, where the concerns about migration from the Middle East and from Africa are unsettling everyone and turning many, many governments, including Sweden, not to mention Germany and France, further to the right, you have to address the concerns of a broad range of people, not just a narrow group of financiers and real estate developers.
Well, your point's well taken, Robert. I guess my objection to it is that it was a dress rehearsal, in effect, for Trump, for Bannon, for Cambridge Analytica, and the Russians, who secretly funded it through the British hedge fund guy, Aaron Banks. That's what I find so unsavory about the whole thing.
Well, the manipulation of perception using tools and concentrated, what you might call distribution systems like Facebook and what have you, is a challenge of our times. But when people walk into the voting booth, however they're inspired, they're expressing something, and pretending it's all false because those people were, how you say, fanning the flames of discord, isn't satisfactory. The people underpinning were irritated, and they're not just fools.
Right.
And somebody gave voice to them with these new technologies. And I think what we've got to do, because it's taken place in Italy, it's taken place in France, it's taken place in Germany, it's taken place with Donald Trump in the United States, we got to turn the corner on how we manage society in relation to economy for a broad-based prosperity strategy. And until we get on to that, I won't demonize the people who played what you might call malicious games with the media as an alternative. You can demonize them along with figuring out how to repair things. And just as my last editorial moment, or concept, I can't stand listening to people berate populism and referring us right back to Germany in the 30s and whatever. We have unrepresentative governments in the developed world everywhere, and until they become more representative, people are going to be outraged and despondent and vulnerable to the persuasion of people like Donald Trump.
Well, Joe, just in closing, though, I entirely agree with everything you're saying. And I think I wish the Democratic Party had learned the lesson from Hillary Clinton talking about the deplorables and were doing exactly what you're saying they should be doing. Is there any inkling that the lessons have been learned from that kind of smugness and dismissing these people who have genuine concerns. And it was very interesting that it's the same constituencies, in effect, supported both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump.
Well, my intuition is that there's a civil war in the Democratic Party, and that the what you might call centrist or corporate Democrats are just as culpable as the Republicans. And people saw them try to patch together an identity politics as a substitute for broad-based economic prosperity. Now, I'm in favor of what the Democratic Party is advocating in many aspects of identity politics, but not as an anesthetic so they can go back to doing their fundraisers with hedge funds and private equity and big corporations. And by dealing with non-economic issues, they can prevail. The Democratic Party has huge, huge problems right now, and the mistrust that was what you might call escalated by the deplorables comment is still inside what you might call the tug of war, the conflict for the soul of that party. And that is a party that no longer represents Lyndon Baines Johnson, or more importantly, Franklin Roosevelt's vision of a good society.
Well, Robert Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you, Robert. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. And he has an article at Project Syndicate with George Soros, A Better Bailout Was Possible. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back joined by activist Mike Farrell, discussing his one-man performance of an updated version of George Shea's climate change play, Dr. Keeling's Curve, which is presented by the Sierra Club. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mike Farrell, a political and social activist, best known for his portrayal of B.J. Honeycutt in the long-running TV series MASH and Jim Hansen in the weekly NBC series Providence. He is playing the role of Dr. David Keeling, the scientist whose research on CO2 gave the world its first warnings of global warming in an updated version of George Shea's climate change play, Dr. Keeling's Curve, presented by the Sierra Club tonight at 7 p.m. at the Broad Theatre in Santa Monica. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Farrell.
Thanks, Ian. Nice to talk to you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Mike. And it's so extraordinary to think that Dr. David Keeling gave his first warning of global warming from his research on CO2 60 years ago. He was, in 1958, he was on the top of those volcano mountains in the Big Island of Hawaii at the observatory there, and did his measurements. And, you know, it's 60 years later, we're still arguing over whether this is real. Come on.
he was part of the International Geophysical Year, which was in itself a revolutionary movement where scientists from all over the world began to examine climate, the world around, and the impact that the climate is having on us and what impact changes in the climate could have. So you're right. I mean, here we are talking about this thing that people have been, I guess it was 1980-something, 88 maybe, when Jim Hansen, former head of NASA, told Congress that global warming is a very real thing. What's that, 40 years ago? What happened, of course, is that rather than just hearing it and determining that it was a serious issue that we ought to deal with, those who felt that their pocketbooks were going to be impacted by an understanding that we had to do something about the abuse, overuse and abuse of fossil fuels decided to launch a negative campaign, a disinformation campaign. And today we have debunkers and deniers sitting in the U.S. Senate and Congress talking about the fact that global warming is a myth and that it's a hoax and not to be worried about it.
You forgot to mention, Mike Farrell, that we have a global warming denier sitting in the Oval Office.
Oh, that one. I don't think of him as often as possible.
Right. Well, but he is an unfortunate fact. So the Keeling curve, which is what Dr. David Keeling came up with, is one of the most compelling pieces of scientific evidence, and it shows that carbon dioxide, CO2, is accumulating in our atmosphere, and CO2, of course, is a greenhouse gas, and greenhouse gases trap heat in the atmosphere to help keep the planet warm. So the more greenhouse gas molecules in the air means more heat is trapped, leading to an overall warming of the planet.
Yep.
So how, there's an old expression, art ends where politics begin. So here you are doing an extremely political presentation, a play, but you've got to, the famous studio head, Sam Goldwyn, said, if you want to send a message in a movie, use Western Union?
Yes. Well, that's quite right. One of the things that George Shea, who wrote the play, and I discussed when he first approached me with the idea was that it couldn't be a lecture, that it had to be a story, it had to be a play, it had to be something that people could sort of hook into and find an interest in. So the decision that George made, I think quite appropriately, was to talk about this fellow, Dave Keeling, Charles David Keeling, and his effectively accidental discovery of this fact of the rising of the level of CO2. So I think once you get the people to sit down and hear from this guy, and I play him now 13 years after his death, effectively saying, I've come back, and I've come back because people aren't getting the message that we were, giving them so many years ago. And here's the story, folks. And we give a little history about the scientists from the 1800s who began to look at this issue, but nobody took it terribly seriously. Few raised questions about it. And then Keeling, his urge, his desire was to be involved in study of science, but science in nature. And that took him to fields of geochemistry and geology. So he wanted to be out in the mountains measuring things and began to discover that glaciers were shrinking and that the CO2 was going up and that there was a link between the two. He looked at it for some time before he really understood the threat. And that threat was made real when he worked with some scientists in different parts of the country, but mostly out here at the Scripps Institute on the West Coast with Roger Revell and Dr. Seuss, the other Dr. Seuss, and discovered that not only the CO2 count is climbing around us, but it's climbing because CO2, as you suggested earlier, is effectively a greenhouse gas that won't allow heat to escape as rapidly as it comes in. And CO2 remains in the atmosphere and builds up and entraps the heat in a gradually more potent way. And it's having enormous impact as we see all around us today.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Farrell, who's a political and social activist, best known for his portrayal of B.J. Honeycutt in the long-running TV series MASH and Jim Hansen in the weekly NBC series Providence. He is playing the role of Dr. David Keeling, the scientist whose research on CO2 gave the world its first warnings of global warming in an updated version of George Shea's climate change play, Dr. Keeling's Curve, presented by the Sierra Club tonight at 7 p.m. at the Broad Theatre in Santa Monica. So this sounds a little bit like this is like the ghost of Dr. David Keeling coming back like a Cassandra to tell us that we're running out of time.
That's it, Beth. Yeah, simply to say, listen, folks, I studied this thing for a long time. Here's what I found. When I passed away, I was concerned. I tried to express my concerns. But scientists, as a kind of group, don't tend to be particularly active. And probably the best example of the fact that scientists are not only activists, but when they become activists, they are generally shunted aside, is Jim Hansen, the former head of NASA, who and Al Gore, who we all know. There are very strong forces in this country that want to put these people outside the mainstream by saying, no, they're cranks or they're in it for some ulterior purpose. Hansen is now, made fun of a bit when they can, but his credentials are so extraordinary that it's really difficult for them to do so. We want Keeling, in this instance, to be one who can point to the issues and say to people, here is what's happening. Here's what we found. Here's what was being said. Here's what the deniers have done. The deniers have created an industry just like they did against cigarette smoking, or in favor of cigarette smoking, against the medical discoveries of the dangers of cigarettes. And that it is up to us as caring, thoughtful people who are interested in the continuation of our civilization to do something about putting the pressure on our leadership to begin to take this seriously.
Well, ironically, though, it's these, moneyed reactionary forces like ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers, etc., they've all hoisted the canard that it's these activist scientists who are lying,
sure.
Or who are, sort of crying wolf.
Mm-hmm.
When, if you know anything about scientists, and I have a bunch of friends who are scientists, they're the most cautious people on the planet.
Indeed.
They go through the most laborious methodology to make their claims, and they, by nature, their claims are always conservative. And, there's peer review every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's an outrageously, stupid thing to suggest, but somehow, they've been successful. We seem to be the only country in the world where we're still even talking about whether or not climate change is real.
Well, as a result, certainly, of the Paris Accord, we have virtually every nation signed onto it, and to our shame and embarrassment, Mr. Trump has taken us out of it. But even as a result of that, many of the governors of states of the Union are saying that they're going to do everything they can to require that we meet the standards, the Paris Accord standards. The problem in the scientific community is even the Paris Accord standards are low.
They're perhaps inadequate, frankly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're unrealistic, and that people, even people in the position of trying to make known the issue, are trying not to terrify people by the fact by the examples of what really is in store for us. You look at look at the fires that have happened this year here in California. Look at the floods that have happened. Look at the superstorms that are happening. For people to begin to make those connections is somewhat difficult sometimes for the folks that have always said, well, the sun comes up every morning, and it's pretty much the same as it always has been. But in fact, all of these things are related, and they are becoming so severe. The changes I think one of the things we say in the play is that there is no 9/11 here. There is no no immediate
catalyst, I guess. Yeah.
Kind of event that wakes everybody up, because every day, you know, we get up and the sun shines.
Right.
But for thousands of years, we haven't understood that there have been these changes over time, and that we are in, for thousands of years, we've been in a relatively benign one, and we're heading, but not only heading naturally, we're headed, what the problem is, the things we're doing with the consumption primarily of fossil fuels and the farming of beef and many of the things we're doing that are creating this buildup of CO2 is accelerating everything. So it's the problem that the way in which our civilization has chosen to propel itself is accelerating the issue and the problem to the point that we are creating what Hansen said may, in fact, preclude the possibility of another natural ice age, because we are going to overheat the planet to the point that it's too late.
Well, just in closing, Mike Farrell, a good friend of mine, I had him on the program a little while ago, Dave Freeman, the former head of the TVA, the New York Power, the DWP. He was the state energy czar in California that rescued us from the predations of Enron. He was saying, you know, if you look at the framing of the great political subjects of the moment, particularly now that we've got Kavanaugh with the possibility of Roe v. Wade being overturned, abortion, for example, the framing of it is you either pro-life or pro-choice. Pro-life is a much more powerful sounding thing than pro-choice. Same with net neutrality, a massively important issue. Net neutrality doesn't tell you anything. What Dave is now arguing is that we shouldn't refer to it as climate change, because the climate does change. We should refer to it as climate damage. What do you think of that concept?
That's an interesting one. You know, climate change is the kind of compromise from global warming. And I think the shift is a difficult one to make, because a lot of people don't grab it. But climate damage is a very, very interesting point, because everybody understands the concept of damage.
And that's what's happening.
Yeah, exactly. It's what's happening.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm not asking you to rewrite the play.
Thank you.
So thanks for joining us, Mike Farrell.
Pleasure, Ian. Nice to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Farrell, who's a political and social activist, best known for his portrayal of B.J. Honeycutt in the long-running TV series Smash, MASH, and Jim Hansen in the weekly NBC series Providence. He is playing the role of Dr. David Keeling, the scientist whose research on CO2 gave the world its first warnings of global warming in an updated version of George Shea's climate change play, Dr. Keeling's Curve, presented by the Sierra Club tonight at 7 p.m. at the Broad Theatre in Santa Monica. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Kathleen Ash and Ricky Herrera. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.